Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Heretic Hammer podcast. I'm your host, Marshall, and this is my co-host, Dylan.
Hello, hello.
And today, we talk about the Immortal Army, the Silver Terminator robots of 40K. We talk about the Necrons.
Ooh.
We see the Necrons now, and, you know, it's a good time, you know, to especially maybe kind of look into Necrons, because Mechanicus 2 got announced recently, and in this one, you know, you'll be able to play as both, or as either Mechanicus or Necrons. You know, they've got some of the best recent books in release, you know, they, from like a fan perspective. And so, and we've, you know, had some reference to them in the past, right? And especially, they got a large section of the first episode in a way when we talked about, you know, the war in heaven, because they're quite important in it. But what are the Necrons? Why did they engage in the war in heaven? Why did they go through everything? That's what we're going to talk about today.
Gotcha.
So, what's funny is the Necrons in total game realm and aspect, they kind of have had two identities. And it's kind of why the joke I made at the beginning exists. And that's when they started, they were just nothing more than robotic space Terminators that would show up and just kill everything that was in the planet or the battlefield or anything. They had no mind, they had no character, they had no nothing. They were just murder robots that randomly would show up on planets and attempt to kill everything. They were just straight up Terminators.
Mm-hmm.
And granted, this was the 80s, you know, so it made, there was sense to that, right? They were obviously taking from plenty of different pop culture things, and so this was just one of those kind of fitting things. If you're going to be starting a grimdark universe, well, Terminator was a grimdark future, so it kind of
and skull sense. Pauldrons were a big part of fashion at the time as well.
Well, especially in the 80s.
Yeah. It was all over the place.
But, you know, then later on, you know, they got their makeover, and while they kept that somewhat Egyptian aesthetic that they still had then, it was refined. It was given character. It was given form. And more importantly, they were finally given lore. And so to kind of somewhat go back and remind ourselves of kind of what it was, what were the Necrons, you know? What was it that brought them to this point? Because, yes, we obviously went over this in the first episode, but it's so intrinsically important to understanding why Necrons are the way that they are, that it's good to kind of revisit it for a moment. Especially now we can kind of go to it from the perspective of the Necrons more closely. So, as somewhat of a reminder, when the Necrons were just their sole race on their home planet, and they were the call, and they were technically just called the Necron Tier, they were a plagued people. Their sun, incredibly, you know, incredibly close to their planet. Essentially, while how there was life to be formed in the first place, who knows? Regardless, their life was a cursed life. They were trapped to, or they were destined to suffer from radiation sicknesses, cancers, and essentially a poison life. And yet they persevered. They pushed through it, eventually advancing.
Nevertheless, she persisted.
Yes. And advancing to the point where they sought to conquer and go through the stars to escape the horrid planet that they had originated from. But unfortunately, the curse of their home planet followed them. Despite going through generations and having new children, they would all still succumb and find themselves plagued with this sickness, with this radiation poison. And they continue to reach out then, you know, find more and more new planets and maybe find some beings out there that could help them. And eventually they did. They found the old ones. And the old ones were, you know, these kind of great, these, they were beings of creation. They, their whole goal and design were, they viewed themselves as the creators of the universe or of life. They were innumerably powerful. And the Necrons saw this, and therefore they were like, this is perfect. You know, you can help us, please. Like, they went to them begging on their knees, just wanting help to save their children, their legacies, their total lives. While they view themselves as creators, they take somewhat a kind of scientific, like, onlooker approach of, we don't interfere in the destinies and the trajectories of where creatures send themselves, right? While we are creators, we are not saviors and destiny changers. And again, like, it's looking at it from the Necron's perspective, right? They have spent, you know, thousands of years working and trying to escape the home planet that was poisoning them. And then they finally do so, and it still doesn't work. And so they try to find answers from everyone else, and they can't find anybody. And then they finally find these godlike beings. They can create life out of seemingly nothing, and they refuse to help because of just choice, as it seems. You know, they would let their children die because of whatever random principle that they have. And this, again, this is speaking from the perspective of the Necrons, right? Whether or not the old ones and what and all that were technically correct to, you know, help them or not is entirely, you know, that's a whole philosophical debate, right? The Necron Tyr looked at this as a slight, you know, that they were being essentially cast aside, that these godlike beings would essentially spit in their face by asking or by telling them no. So they engaged in war at one point where there were multiple, you know, dynasties and, you know, different planets that would maybe have fought with each other and squabbled and all that, all united to fight against the old ones. They inevitably found themselves, because they were losing constantly against the old ones, they were just outmatched and outclassed in every way. Eventually, the current leader of the Necrons, the Silent King, or the Necron Tyr, I should say, the Silent King, met with a creature called the Catan in the Deceiver. But he wasn't obviously, and that wasn't his name at the time, right? But that's what he's known as now.
He was just Catan previously.
Yeah, he was just like, I am this great being. I am called the Catan. And we have been at war with the old ones. And, you know, he spun this tale of, you know, we've been at war with the old ones. They too refuse to coincide with us. They use their powers for themselves and they create life, but they don't, you know, they use it irresponsibly and all that. But
source, trust me, bro.
Yeah, well, I mean, he was trying to pull, you know, the we're in the same boat kind of thing, right? Like, they screwed us like they screwed you. You know, but the Catan were these, in the physical space, these star gods. They were large creatures, and their food source was essentially to siphon out and destroy and snuff out suns. they would go to stars and just drain them of energy.
And that's not good.
Yeah, and this would obviously just destroy the galaxy or the, you know, the solar system that they were a part of. Mm-hmm. But they didn't obviously say this part. And so eventually they came to an agreement. You know, we will give you this power and immortality you seek if we work together to fight against the old ones. And again, it was just that thing of they were so blinded by this rage and thirst for revenge that, you know, they agreed. And, you know, Sarek, the Silent King, which is the essentially the name of the King of Necron Tyr, you know, agreed with them and joined in. And there's kind of two periods. So the first thing they did is they gave, you know, the Catan almost it's this type of metal that the Necrons are currently made out of, called Necrodermis, which is like a living metal. And sure. They were able to essentially give these star gods bodies in order to essentially exist in the physical world in a ways that they never used to be able to. You know, they were almost kind of ethereal beings at the time, despite that they did technically, you know, exist in the physical realm, you know, so they weren't chaos gods. Those didn't exist at the time. They were able to create these physical forms for them, and they could now almost kind of engage in the war with them. And then on top of that, the Catan did their, and what gave the deceiver his name, and the way they tricked the Necrons was eventually bringing Sarek into the into this furnace. Essentially, they told him, you know, enter through this and you will gain the immortality you seek. And he goes through it, and his flesh is incinerated. And so the necrodermis that they had given to the Catan was now enwrapped around their bones, really. And
oh, like it was bonded to them?
Yeah, their flesh burned away. The necrodermis enwrapped around the bones that they had, turning them essentially into these machines.
Mm.
And the issue that suddenly Sarek realizes upon leaving is he's missing something. Something about him feels off. It's his soul. See, the Catan realized what they needed, or what was kind of was becoming more juicy than having the energy from stars, was souls.
Okay.
And they took this as an opportunity then to, whether through kind of blind, you know, trickery or just by dragging them in, all of the Necron Tyr were dragged into these furnaces and turned into the Necrons that we know them to be today.
At what point did the Catan realize that souls to them were more, like, gave them more power than the energy from feeding off the stars did? Like, did they realize that, like, before that, or was it at that moment?
It's most likely around that moment, but yeah, like, because this was obviously their plan all along when they realized kind of what the Necron had with these Necrodermis. But, you know, it could be said that while they were engaging in war with the old ones up to that point, like the initial stages of the war in heaven, like very early stages, where it was more even, that they were potentially siphoning souls while in the battlefields. And maybe realize, there's some juiciness.
Yeah, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah, so then that's there's not enough to say where exactly, you know, they realized, oh, this could be a good idea. And so this process then was called the Great Biotransference.
Great Biotransference, okay.
Yeah, where the process itself, the biotransference part, taking hold over all of the Necron tier, turning them into Necrons, where at the time especially, they had then also kind of installed, because their souls and what their personalities were essentially just became essentially like AI chips in their brain that in some respect could still feel, you know, the emotion and have the thoughts and concepts that they once had, but they were lacking the true soul that lets them essentially just kind of feel and be a part of the galaxy that they know it to be. Zarek is the only one who is, quote unquote, gifted the capacity to not have, you know, the essentially his brain turned off, because the Catan essentially give him these keys. They turn everyone's brains off and turn them into mindless soldiers who will follow orders no matter what. And they give him the keys. They keep him with his sentience, and they give him the keys. Because they look at it as like, see, look at this great thing we've done for you. Here you go.
And does he not just immediately turn them against the Catan in that case? Because they just handed him an army and said, hey, we know we just like didn't give you what you want and totally screwed you over. See, but here's an army. We're good, right? We're pals.
Yeah, I mean, Sarek's a smart guy. And he's a smart leader. And he understands that he needs to give it time. Because if he attempts to do that immediately, he's the only one with the keys, right? So if he attempts to do that immediately, all the Catan that are there are just going to gang up on him and destroy him. And then they'll just take the keys for himself, right? So how do you deal with that then? Well, you give it time. You wage the war with the Catan further. You know, especially the best thing you can do is continue what you did set out to do, at least, right? Because while as a king, you know, he can't live in regret. He has to move forward. He has to lead his people somehow. And so he might as well do at least the thing he set out to do in the first place and kill all the old ones. And they effectively do that, you know, thus at that last ditch effort, the old ones create the Eldar and the Quarks. And then that's only so enough. But it's within that period of time that the hubris of the Catan really starts to set in, right? And all of a sudden, they start to squabble with each other. They, you know, think of each other as like, oh, I'm going to go for this. No, I'm going to go for this. No, I'm on this. No, this is my part. This is my part. That's your part. This is mine.
Infighting.
Exactly. And it's within this that Zarek sees his opportunity to then turn his tides against them. And it is within this that, you know, the Catan's hubris really comes to fold. They were so full of themselves and so self-absorbed that they just didn't see this coming. Like, this is the thing, right? They aren't truly, like, while they're all powerful, right? Like, they had so much power. They had godlike power. They were not omnipotent. They
weren't all prescient. They weren't...
Yeah.
They didn't have the...
They couldn't, like, see every realm of the future, you know?
Yeah, they didn't have the foresight or anything to actually be able to capitalize on.
So, in a way, they had a very human-like aspect to think that while they were had all this... Because they had all this power, that nothing could hurt them, you know? Mm-hmm. No, they would never be betrayed by Zarek. The Necrons could never be turned against them. Until they did. And they shattered the Catan into multiple shards and trapped them into these essentially machines and crypts to never be released and brought back together again. And in fact, the Necrons would turn them into weapons themselves, using shards of these Catans in their battles to devastating effect, yes, but essentially turning their slavers into slaves themselves. And then, which by the way, one of the more popular Catan shards, the Shard of the Void Dragon, one of the best models.
Now that's a in 40K.
That is. This is, yeah, this is a sick model. It's super cool. But eventually, you know, they go through all this. And then you have, you know, you had the Eldar and the Quarks who were, you know, very much kind of gaining steam. And Zer kind of saw, like, okay, like, there's a lot going on. We don't need to push this war any further. Let's do what we can do. Because he realized there's one thing that they have that everyone else doesn't. Time. Eventually, time will come for all creatures, all organic creatures, right? And they will die at some point. So he figured we can go into slumber, wait it out, go deep into these our worlds, and rest for 60 million years. We can come back, awaken, and retake the galaxy and try to right the wrongs that we've done. And in that, he exiles himself. He goes off into deep space to seek out answers himself while his essentially subjects slumber. But the last thing he does just before he goes to sleep, he sends them to sleep, is he turns off the essentially the inhibitor that keeps the that essentially turned off the personalities and in you know brain pieces that existed in the Necrons.
But did he also get rid of the key that allowed him to control that in the first place? Yeah,
like that's what that was. By getting rid of that command protocol, he also, that means he threw away the key, right? So now when they awaken, they will be free and mindful to do what they wish. And these then became what are known as Tomb Worlds. And now in the 41st millennium, these Tomb Worlds are awakening. And we've got now, whether it be from, you know, the source, the first time the Imperium sees it, which is, you know, a Mechanicus, you know, pressing some buttons on a console and then suddenly being like, why is everything waking up around here? Uh-oh.
Who turned on the lights?
Yeah. And now the Necrons are awakening. And not only that, but Sarek has returned to the galaxy because he has seen a new threat that inhibits his plan. See, Sarek, he wishes to see the Necrons return to flesh, right? He wants to not only right his wrongs from the sense of just like making it up to his people and all that, but he wants to reverse the biotransference. And his kind of thought process became, you know, we need to find suitable host species that we can essentially defeat from a, you know, governmental stance and all that, and then take its people and transfer our minds into their bodies, thus reversing biotransference, right?
Okay.
And unfortunately, there's this threat across the world called the Tyranids, and they specifically have the goal to consume all bioorganic creatures in a galaxy. And so if they do that, that means there's no beings for the Necrons to put their minds back into.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a little tough.
Because that's the thing, is the Tyranids would otherwise ignore the Necrons because they're not a bioorganic in any way anymore. They're a machine. So they would just ignore them and they would move on with their day. But the Silent King wants to reverse his biotransference and he needs organic creatures to do so. And the Necrons or the Tyranids aren't it. So he is back to try to unite his people and fight against the Tyranids. And then, you know, also subjugate other races and all that. But that is currently where he stands and kind of they stand in that. But otherwise, across the galaxy, these two worlds are awakening. So the nobles of those, you know, there were higher end nobles that existed. And a lot of those were called the Pharaons, and which are, you know, the specific overlords that rule over the entire dynasty. Because there are overlords which look over multiple tomb worlds. A number of these Pharaons woke up and kind of decided, well, we don't have a Silent King, so I'm going to decide how I think we should wake up and move toward. Or, and then another one would be like, but I have a different idea. And there are a number of dynasties that exist there, there are different points where others may awaken and have different thoughts and make their own dynasty, stuff like that. Others will get subjugated or they'll join and unite under a different dynasty. And so there are a number of different ones, which we'll kind of get into in a second. But there's a couple of types of Necrons that I want to get into first. So your basic Necron that you generally see in most arts or video games or whatnot are going to be like your warriors and immortals. So your warriors are just very much, you look at them and you're like, that just kind of looks like skeleton Terminator guy.
Right. Yes.
And the big thing is they will use what is called Gauss weaponry, and same with the immortals, which look the same, just uses a heavier gun. And Gauss weaponry is possibly one of the most dangerous and effective weapons in all of 40K. Because when you are shot with a Gauss weapon, you know, you are shot, say like you are shot in the face, it will peel off your armor. It will then continue, and it will blast through and peel away your skin, your skeleton, until you are nothing but dust. Granted, this is almost all in a moment. So the amount of pain is probably pretty small, but a pretty rough way to go, nonetheless, just being turned to dust from like one blast. And the other important thing that this necrodermis does for Necrons, the necrodermis is a living metal and it self repairs. So you can kill a Necron, but it will come right back up.
Oh, yeah.
It'll start, you know, the things will start kinking back together, and then all of a sudden it comes in, wakes up, starts blasting again. Now there's a limit to this, right? It's the, you know, the laws of matter, right? You can only have so much matter, and so they can only repair themselves so many times. Or if you just happen to essentially hit them the right way, where you've essentially broken their brain hard drive, they won't, you know. So there is a point, right? Even though they reanimate, it is not forever. Which is why, like many things in the 40K universe, the answer still really is to, in order to deal with it, you shoot it. Or stab it, cut it apart, you know, take a pick.
Yeah, yeah.
But
dealer's choice.
Yeah. But like many things in the 40K universe that seem horrifically overpowered, because everything in the 40K universe, one way or another, is horrifically overpowered, you deal with it by shooting it. But again, there's a sensibility to it, because even though they can self-repair and reanimate, there's only so much material that you can always reanimate from. They can obviously find ways to greater repair themselves later and get more material to themselves so that they can then reanimate more effectively in the future. Otherwise, another unit that is of good note is called a Deathmark, which is a sect of Necrons that are sniper assassins. They have two distinct abilities. Obviously, their gun, which not only penetrates and will, you know, and kill a foe in mere moments, but it will almost kind of explode from inside of their body in a way. Like, the shot will ring out, hit you, and then will spread almost an acid throughout your body. Whoa. Completely shutting you down from the inside. It's way more brutal than the Gauss weapon. The Gauss weapon's like that. This one you will suffer a bit. You're going to feel it.
Yeah, that sounds horrible.
But the other thing that they have is they have the capacity to teleport themselves around the battlefield and even just to various locations. So they are very hard to pin down because they will just open a portal into another spot and just walk through it. And they calculate, they have all the calculations to kind of figure out where they need to put it. You know, especially if you're already on one of their tomb worlds, they already have all that information of locations and whatnot kind of down. But they'll otherwise have like surveyed all of the possible locations when they are entering in a zone where they need to be, so that if they face resistance, they can figure out where they can teleport out. So they're very hard to deal with, and having a death mark sent against you is a lot of times a death sentence. Otherwise, there's a whole other segment of Necrons called the Destroyer Cults. And Destroyers have kind of a distinct aspect about them in that they very much refuse the concept of undoing the biotransference. They accept and push through their robotic mechanical nature. They have not only learned to accept who they are, but they wish for it. And not only that, though, they wish to just destroy any form of organic life. They see organic life as lesser and a plague to the universe. Nothing to be resolved.
When I saw the weakness of my flesh, yada, yada, yeah. Yada.
But it's more about when I saw the weakness of your flesh.
Yeah, yeah.
When I saw the weakness of your flesh on my lawn.
I got the ick.
Get off my lawn.
Mm-hmm.
So, destroyer cults include a couple of things. So, there's, you know, heavy destroyers or locusts, which kind of have these, like, scarab-like floating backs that they kind of hover from. So, they're almost kind of like a centaur where, like, their main body is a Necron torso. But then instead of having legs and bottom, they have what looks like a giant floating scarab body because, you know, Egyptian kind of look and all that.
Right, right.
Otherwise, you'll have Scorpex, which are also destroyers, which will have generally these are, you know, very heavy, large melee units, and they are quadrupedal with very knife-like legs. And again, they only seek to destroy. So if anything, a lot of times these can maybe be ones, especially by like nobles and, like the scientists and nobles of tomb worlds kind of may look at them as, you know, brutish and lesser minded, but that doesn't mean that they will reject them or leave them alone or have never use them, because to ignore them and to leave them be is a fool's errand. They are powerful weapons and tools to be used. And so even though a noble may look down on them, that don't mean that they ain't going to use them. They will.
Mm-hmm.
And then the kind of final segment for like a proper Necron and things, something that's kind of gone wrong over the many millions of years that they were in slumber, is a virus has kind of plagued through a number of Necrons called the Flayer virus. And what this does is it drives a Necron to seek the consumption of flesh. For whatever reason, when this begins to take fold, you know, it's first it'll be, you know, they'll just maybe grab like a finger or a small portion of a limb or something, you know, from, you know, an organic creature or humanoid that they fight. And they'll kind of keep it. And then eventually this kind of drives more and more, and they are just filled with this drive to consume flesh. There's a problem with this, though. Now, you've noticed, probably, all these Necrons appear to have what looks like mouths, but these mouths do not.
They're not, though. They're just like a thin slit.
It's essentially where their teeth were. It's the skull that was there, but it's fused together. But those were essentially where their teeth maybe were. You know, conceptually, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're filled with this drive to consume flesh that they cannot consume. And so they will adorn it to themselves. They'll take flesh and wrap it around themselves, and they will go mad, essentially. They are so driven that they just fall prey to this. But their real tragedy as well is that while they are by all means insane, as a Necron would go, they are still fairly conscious of not only themselves, but of their loyalty. Because Necrons still, even after all of this, you know, shaping and shifting and, you know, personality changes and cultures that they've kind of, set up between, you know, being a destroyer, or, you know, death marks, just normal warriors. Despite all of them having their own realms of culture, they are all still incredibly loyal and driven by that monarchical society that they once had. They look at their lords and kings as almost godlike leaders. And the Flayed Ones are no exception. And in fact, they're potentially some of the most loyal. But when they appear, they just kind of appear seemingly out of nowhere. Because when one becomes a Flayed One, they are cast out from society. They are rejected by all the other Necrons. And so despite their incredibly loyal and will always show up and help the Necron wherever they fight, they will always be cast out, shunned from those that they still feel so much loyalty to. But finally, a not specifically like Necron, but like a fun new toys makeup, is their little scarab friends, which are essentially just tiny robots that they've used for now, especially to self-repair themselves and all their equipment. But at the time when they were probably first made, to inevitably maintain and fix any equipment and ships that they had, of which they do traverse through the stars. They do eventually, there's two ways of the reasons they'll traverse the stars. They awaken, they take over their planet, and thus then are like, we need to go remove all of these other beings from the galaxy because the galaxy belongs to us. The other reason is some tomb worlds, quote unquote, are actually ships out in space. They are just these gigantic fleet vessels that are a tomb world on a giant spaceship. And the design for a lot of ships and units and whatnot, they kind of get the lovingly named crescent or croissant. Crescent would be the nice name to give them, but they are
crescent makes sense, but croissant's the fun one.
The croissant. Now let's talk about two other very notable characters. So first, I want to talk about Imhotep the Stormlord. He is the Pharaon of the Sautek dynasty. So, and he is almost kind of the antithesis character to Zarek. He views the Necron form as, this is what it is meant to be. This is what we are. much kind of like the Destroyer cults, right? Where it's like, this is what we are.
Yeah.
We should embrace this. And we need to unite under the one banner. So that part's the same. But instead, to make the galaxy ours and eliminate everyone else, but maintain our robotic form. And instead improve upon it, if anything else. You know, so if anything, honestly, he probably would be, technically in some respects, he'd probably be somewhat okay, you know, with having Tyranids or Chaos kind of destroy everyone else, because it's like, well, it don't matter to me. Neither of them can do anything to me. So whatever. Go ahead. We'll just kind of deal with you afterward. Because, well, yeah, Tyranid can destroy a Necron and still be a problem to Necron. So they're not going to be allies by any means. A Tyranid would only fight a Necron in self-defense. You know, they're not going to necessarily seek to consume or destroy them on their own. Like, they're not, if they can just, if they, you know, if a Tyranid were to look into a, you know, fleet, were to look at a planet that only has Necrons on it, they would just look at it and be like, and it's like a straight desert planet, nothing else alive except for the Necrons. They would just see it as like, there is no life on this planet. Goodbye. And leave, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But if the Necrons showed up on a world that the, say the Tyranids are Nominon stuff, and they were like, hey, get away, and they shot at the Tyranids would obviously then defend themselves. So that's kind of where at least that still would come together on. But regardless, the, you know, Emotech himself seeks to unify all of the Necrons together in order to kind of bring them as a whole, as a full force to be able to push forward with, you know, united under one banner. In fighting needs to be just out of the question. It's got to stop because we have bigger fish to fry, you know?
Mm-hmm. But united as they are, not as they were.
Yes, exactly. Then another one of the most fun characters of Necron lore is that of Trazen the Infinite. Trazen is a special guy.
Okay.
So he is a self-proclaimed archaeovist. He, you know, has, he is from the tomb world of Solemnness, but his big thing is his library. So he kind of views himself as like a historian, an observer. And he is completely obsessed to just find moments that he thinks tells the story of the universe.
Mm.
And essentially, and capture them. Like, he is such technology that he essentially has the capacity to, in what are kind of colloquially kind of known as like what we, what is, or, you know, jokingly called Pokeballs.
Okay.
But like, you know, are these, you know, is this device, this giant device that can essentially freeze time in even a wide location, kind of shrink it down and capture it. So literally like taking a moment or a person or like some multiple people in a battlefield, a literal moment in time, and he takes it to, you know, his tomb and essentially has it be part of his own museum.
Does he have an end goal, or is the whole infinite thing like, he's just going to keep doing this forever?
Yeah. I mean, he kind of sees the, I mean, until he kind of feels like he, essentially until he sees the end of the universe, he has infinite amount of things to collect and acknowledge and find. And as a result of this, he is very much himself a wild card. You know, there have been many characters in 40K that have made random deals with him that have, you know, been that he's made allies of convenience with, you know, that he's made enemies with. A good example is there is a very powerful Necron weapon called the Celestial Orrery. This was made back in the War in Heaven. And this was a weapon that essentially has an entire map, a living map, so it constantly updates, of the Milky Way galaxy. And essentially you can point at a star on that map and cause it supernova.
Oh.
It is just as simple as that. You know, so it is protected very heavily by the dynasty that controls it. And they, because inevitably, I from what I can tell, they seem to also kind of be a dynasty that maybe looks at the universe as, you know, like a scenario of like a, hey, we may want to inhabit this universe someday, so let's not just kind of get rid of everything. So they protect it very, very diligently, but as a result, Trazen, you know, because it doesn't mean that you can't negotiate with the dynasty to try to maybe find some use of it or whatever. So he used it to try to help him find an object. But he's such a troll and effectively, you know, a goober that he walked in, had this discussion with them. And this is in the book, The Infinite and the Divine. Had this discussion with them and then was banned from ever using it again. And in that book, The Infinite and the divine part relates to Orokon, the diviner, who is a type of Necron called a chronomancer, which, again, this is kind of a thing where it's like, you know, Necrons don't have like warp power, but they can almost kind of use, like, their technology is so seismic when they were, especially when they're in great power, that they could almost do magical like things with their technology. I mean, they are what they sound like. They are lookers into the future and time, and, you know, attempt to be masters of time. And Orokon is also kind of known because he was the only dissenter to what the Deceiver was granting the Necron tier. Cause he kind of looked at doing it like, this is going to be bad. This ain't going to work this way. He and Trazen, because of that book, are somewhat, looked at together almost, like, indicatively at this point. And so finally then, to get into the gameplay tabletop side of things, the Necrons are a pretty kind of open book when it comes to what you can choose on how to play them. You know, there are a number of options in terms of, you know, you can build a very destroyer cult heavy, you know, list, right? You can build one where you run a lot of warriors and immortals, you know, and you're a little light on the destroyers. You know, you can have your flayed ones. Scarabs are a unit that you can use. And then what was recently a whole thing, which was Catan spam, because they used the shards of Catans as weapons. They are models in the game, though the only one that has had any form of recent good-looking model is the Void Dragon. Every other one is old and kind of ugly-looking. So we've got Banana Head McGillicuddy here in his really good-looking model set. And then we've got
Captain Staryu.
Yeah, and then we've got the Grim Reaper with his weirdly open mouth and scythe that doesn't take this picture very well at all.
They don't look horrible, but I can definitely see why, how like the Void Dragon is better looking overall.
Yeah, it's like it's just like in comparison, right? Especially.
Yeah. I mean, it's just got a lot more interesting things going on with it. The other two are very like the form wise and tone wise, they're just very kind of like one or two note.
And they're also fine cast, which makes them pretty wonky to deal with and all that. Because it's such a, it's such like a brittle and not amazing form of resin. But that is a form of gameplay style you can do. Is you can just buy a bunch of Catan and then pretty much just run a bunch of those. Although I think that fell out of style recently. So not a recommendable way to get into Necrons. But otherwise,
out of fashion.
Yeah. Otherwise, there are plenty of the characters that we talked about today that have all their models. They can survive perfectly fine in melee, but they are very, because they are also slow. That's the big thing about Necrons. In lore in the game, they are slow. They lumber forward in the battlefield.
Have we had many units that are like particularly slow? I'm trying to think about the ones that would have been
main one.
Because even like the orcs aren't even like super slow, are they?
No, not at all. No, the thing that gives them any speed are the, you know, something like the Scarabs, and there are other, you know, there's a segment called the Wraiths, which are kind of their mindless drone units, though the Wraiths are look kind of Necron-y. They have like the Necron face, but then, you know, have kind of a, you know, a long body with long claws, but they're not great attack. They're not heavy or great attackers. But they move fast, and the Canoptics are what the Scarabs are, and they're generally like your just totally mindless unit. But otherwise, yeah, the only other army that is kind of as slow as the Necrons is the Death Guard, which, you know, in the game, like in the board game, you know, is very much, yeah, its own army and all that, but they are a form of Chaos Space Marine, right? So there are other Chaos Space Marines that aren't slow, but the Death Guard are the main army that is just slow as well. You know, some of the other ones maybe aren't as fast as others, right? But they aren't deliberately slow. But they do have vehicles and transports and stuff that obviously help with this. So that's kind of an up to you thing on how you want to run them and all that. But that is always kind of the thing that helps differentiate and give the Necrons kind of, you know, their identity. So they also have, you can kind of see it in some of the images, especially like in the background. They have what are called monoliths, which are kind of these just like giant mobile pyramids, which again, also slow, but they utilize these like powerful arc attacks because like, the third weapon type that I didn't mention that I skipped over a little bit is they have kind of essentially these giant arc weaponry, which are just essentially like just horridly Tesla or their Tesla weaponry. And there's that sounds, they just shoot massive amounts of lightning and arcs off to multiple units and stuff like that. These monoliths have that, but in a much grander scale. And they'd also just kind of lumberly float across the battlefield, which is great in Dawn of War because, you know, like classic RTSs like Warcraft and stuff like that, you know, you upgrade your HQ to like, you know, get better units and stuff like that. You know, there's like a tier 1, 2, 3 HQ. The tier 3 HQ for Necrons, the HQ itself then is the monolith. So like tiers 1 and 2, it's just planted in the ground like a normal HQ, but tier 3, it actually comes up and floats across the battlefield and you can use it as a unit. It is so good. But yeah, that is basically it for the Necrons. They they are a warning tale of obsession. Yeah,
cautionary tale,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, of revenge and obsession of said revenge. But, you know, in a way, they feel that they can still advance themselves one way or the other, whether it be, you know, by...
We can still turn this around, guys.
Yeah, by either reversing their transference or accepting who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know what? Anybody can find... Any of us as readers and as fans can... You know, give our reasons why we would choose or we would side with either concept, right? One with maybe a bit of a noble, kind of benevolent kind of reasoning, despite, you know, the normal 40K thing of still wanting to rule the universe, or sticking with their guns and moving forward mm-hmm. with what they have and rebuilding their society with who they are. Up to you. But the Necrons are a very cool unit, very cool faction, somber in some ways. But then you have things like Trazen, which really bring you back into the fold. But yeah, anything else about the Necrons that you want to talk about?
No, it was pretty comprehensive, and I do like them. I think they're pretty cool.
Next week, we're going to commit some heresy again. Okay. Instead of going back to humans, we're going to Tyranids, the Great Devourer.
Yeah.
And it'll kind of be a double episode. And this is partly due to GW's stupidness of not giving Tyranids enough lore. But it'll be a kind of combo of... It'll be Tyranids as a whole, but in it will include the Gene Stealer cults. As I deem them too pivotal to Tyranid lore to separate them. We could always do a future episode and thing with them, but I think for baseline lore episodes that we're kind of starting with and all that here, put them together.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, we'll see you next week then. Thank you so much for listening or watching, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.